The date is Tuesday, September 27th, 2016. The time is 2:01 p.m. This is a hearing of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. The location is the hearing room in Suite 1140BN, 441 4th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. We're here pursuant to D.C. Law 6-10, the Rental Housing Act of 1985 as amended. I'm Chairman Peter Segedy-Mazak, and I'll serve to chair this hearing. With me today on my right is Commissioner Diana Harris-Epps, and on my left, Commissioner Michael Spencer. We have an appeal today in regards to the housing accommodation located at 330 Taylor Street Northeast, Unit 32. The case number is RHTP1530710. The appeal is styled Lawrence Caldwell, tenant appellant, versus Horning Management Company, LLC, housing provider appellee. Commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the tenant appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Lawrence Caldwell, tenant appellant.
And for the housing provider appellee?
Timothy Cole on behalf of Horning Management, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. Briefly like to explain our procedures. Our rules are largely similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present your case, beginning with the tenant appellant. The tenant appellant may reserve up to 5 minutes of your 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the case of the housing provider appellee. The housing provider appellee must present your entire argument within 20 minutes, and we'll have no rebuttal time. In our discretion, we will allow extra time in light of questions that we may ask you. The Commission's hearing will be recorded on audio CD. Our decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties in the next 30 to 45 days. In this proceeding, we do not request nor will we accept post-hearing submissions. As the clerk noted, please turn off any cell phones or other electronic devices. Probably know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyhow. Do you have, do you believe, Mr. Caldwell, that settlement negotiations at this stage would be helpful, and would you like to engage in them before we proceed with this appeal? We have on staff an extremely experienced settlement agent who has settled a number of cases for us. Both parties have to agree to this, Mr. Caldwell, so I'm just posing this as an opportunity, possibly, if you're interested in settling this case. And so I ask you, the mechanics of this would be we would then stay this hearing, allow our settlement agent to discuss this with you, any opportunities, and she is entirely walled off from us. So there's a Chinese wall that would be built between us. We don't know that. She is dealing with you exclusively. So I ask you, sir, do you have any interest in trying to pursue further settlement on this?
We're here today, Your Honors, as a result of a settlement entered into November 5, 2015, in the LTB, Landlord-Tenant Branch, which was immediately breached by Mr. Cole and his clients. I would also note that the mediation ordered by this court below on October 15, 2015, before Judge Bruch, counsel didn't make an appearance, didn't state any reason why he was absent, and so I doubt very much that at this stage mediation is a real possibility.
Very good, sir. Mr. Cole, do you have anything to add to that?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, then we will proceed with this hearing. There is a preliminary matter that I'd like to address. Yesterday, we received a motion from Mr. Caldwell. entitled Emergency Motion for a Continuance Due to Housing Provider's Failure to Serve Responsive Brief on Tenant. The essence of Mr. Caldwell's motion was that the housing provider, appellee, did not timely provide him a responsive brief within the 10-day period plus mailing time as required by the commission's rules. Without such brief, Mr. Caldwell maintains that he was unable or would be unable to respond to any of the arguments made by the appellee, and so he asked for a continuance. He also noted that there was some bad faith, continuing bad faith, and so also requested sanctions. On motions, we don't typically rule as a panel. We rule as an individual judge can rule on a motion. Do you have a copy of this, Mr. Cole?
I believe Mr. Caldwell just handed me his motion today.
Okay. Mr. Cole, do you have any explanation or reason why your brief was considerably later, submitted considerably later than the time periods within our regulations?
I do not. I finished the brief in time, and I assumed that it had been mailed by my staff. I did not realize that it was not timely filed until I received Mr. Caldwell's motion.
Okay. Typically, historically, the remedy for this in a situation like this is to strike the brief that is untimely from our consideration, unless there is good reason, good cause not to strike. In light of the explanations provided here, and a written order will follow, I will follow our tradition and our prior practice and strike the brief submitted by Horning Management, so that the only brief that we will consider will be Mr. Caldwell's on behalf of the appellant. That does not prejudice anyone to the extent that, albeit I'm certain Mr. Cole acted in good faith, for whatever reason, there was not compliance with our rules. Now, there's a second element to this that I will also rule on. I see no bad faith in this. I don't detect any ill behavior by Mr. Cole in this. It was obviously it appears at least to have been a mistake, an honest mistake, based on whatever miscommunication within his office. And so now, Mr. Cole will not be, we will not consider Mr. Cole's brief. And we will then thus just have Mr. Caldwell's brief. Mr. Cole, I want to assure you there are many situations I have dealt probably in 8 years with more situations where there's one brief or no brief submitted. So the presumption would be that you would rely on the arguments provided below by the judge and support those arguments. And so those arguments have their own legal support provided by the court. So I presume that the presumption is that you would simply mimic those and support those.
Yes, sir.
Now, on the other hand, Mr. Caldwell, I don't see any reason to grant a continuance. Yours is the only brief we're going to consider. And so, in the interests of judicial economy, We're simply going to proceed, and our decision, I will issue the decision in writing following this hearing. Short of that, I now ask Mr. Caldwell, do you want to reserve any of your 5 minutes that you have as rebuttal out of your 20 minutes in your presentation?
Yes, Your Honor. I would prefer to have the full 5 minutes.
The full 5 minutes. Okay, sir. Great. Okay, Mr. Caldwell, please start. We have, you've been, I also want to say this. I presume you're not a lawyer. Am I correct?
That's right, Your Honor.
Well, I want to also say that some of your writing is better than most of us, a lot of the writing that's provided by lawyers here. So you've done a remarkably good job in presenting your case as a lawyer would. So I thank you for that, and we as a commission honor that as very helpful to us. Okay.
Thank you,
sir. Okay, and please start. You can sit down, sir. There's no reason. You just take it from your chair.
Judge Pearson made a decision based on what she thought was an agreement that was bilateral, but she considered it unilaterally, and she didn't have the actual document. As the court may be aware, when you photocopy something, you can turn the toner up so that the writing becomes clearer. But the actual document I received at the negotiation was the third copy of a manifold form. And I have macular degenerative disease in my right eye. I am blind in my left eye. I listened to the representations of counsel, his clients, and the mediator, Mr. Mark Moskowitz, and he would write and verbalize, then go out of the room, come back, and eventually all the parties came into the room. There were verbal agreements and obligations, as well as those that were penned by the mediator. The documents of dismissal were supposed to be formulated and filed by November 13 of 2015. Mr. Cole agreed to do that. He did not. We also agreed that the settlement involved all the other cases, including this one, which would be dismissed with prejudice if Mr. Cole and his clients lived up to their end of the bargain. As the court may understand from my brief, this was a bilateral contract with obligations on both sides, and the record shows that counsel and his clients were the first to breach the contract in significant ways.
Let me ask you this. Our jurisdiction is limited, especially when it relates to the enforcement of agreements between parties. Whether or not they've been breached is not our call. that's typically the call of a civil court, and in this case it would be Superior Court. When we've issued decisions, Mr. Caldwell, we don't know if they're enforceable or not by the parties. We don't monitor that. What happens is that if there is a breach of enforcement of any type, a party goes to Superior Court, hands them our ruling, and says, this was issued by the Rental Housing Commission, this ruling, and it's not being enforced by the other party. This is what the Rental Housing Commission said the other party should do, and it's not being enforced. In other words, Mr. Caldwell, you wouldn't come back to us and say, Horning isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing. You would go to Superior Court to do that. They're the enforcement mechanism for our decisions. Okay? breaches, if I can just finish real quick, and you'll have plenty of time to discuss this. The alleged breach of the agreement by Horning that you allege does not and did not, according to the judge below, invalidate what was initially the both parties' agreement to settle. This was post-settlement. So there was an agreement to settle that was reduced to writing that both parties signed, and that began this whole thing. That's regarded as the settlement. Now, what happens after that, whether the parties actually act out what they're supposed to do, is a question of enforcement. And so, as a result, since the settlement was negotiated at Superior Court would have jurisdiction to enforce that settlement agreement. We don't. So I merely want to say this to you because I don't want you to use your time trying to make the same arguments you made below. What I would like you to do, if you can, sir, is focus on what the judge did wrong below. And the judge, what could the judge have done below in light of the fact that this was a settlement agreement that was breached over which she could not enforce it? That's a Superior Court action. What did she do wrong in her decision, in your view, legally, under the Rental Housing Act? And I don't want you to waste your time. I don't want you to make legal arguments that really would carry no weight with us right now. I'd like you to focus on Judge Pearson's decision below, and what did she do under her regs or under the Rental Housing Act that you found to be objectionable and illegal, for that matter. If you could focus on that rather than on the claimed breaches. We can't go to the merits of those breaches or not. We don't have that jurisdiction. Okay? So could you focus on what you think she did wrong as a matter of law?
She admits in her order that she noted the rules require both parties to agree to a dismissal. Mr. Cole submitted a unilateral dismissal, which I thereafter opposed. She felt on the basis, and that's why I presented this difference, that this was sufficient and it was in context to allow her to go outside the rules, contrary to my opposition that there was a breach that significantly changed everything, and she awarded the entire case, as it were, to Mr. Cole.
And so your point is, I think it's a legitimate point, legally, that this was not a joint motion. That the court, even though it had a settlement agreement, allegedly, to which you consented, your consent to the settlement agreement could not be taken as a consent to file a motion to dismiss below. That was not the same type of consent. It was a different type of consent. Is that a fair way of restating it, sir?
Yes, I think so, Judge. I believe Judge Pearson should have, at the very least, held a hearing where we could have fleshed this out and made a determination as to what should take place, rather than just on a paper record based entirely to the advantage of counsel to make a ruling that was dispositive.
Now, I'm going to ask you a tougher question, okay, as a matter of law, okay? For some reason, you did not file a notice of appeal, a timely notice of appeal below. What you filed was when I say a notice of appeal, I mean a motion to reconsider. You filed a reconsideration past the 10-day period that reconsiderations are required below, and the judge treated that as a different type of motion. It was a motion for relief from judgment that has a specific list of criteria that that it can be filed within 120 days of the issuance of the decision, not 10 days, okay? And a separate appealable order, okay? So that's what happened below. She said, I'm going to interpret, I can't accept Mr. Caldwell's reconsideration as timely, therefore it's not a reconsideration. What I will do under our regs is I'm going to interpret it as a motion for relief from judgment, okay? And she evaluated your motion on reconsideration as a motion for relief from judgment. The reason I ask you, I pose you as the legal question I have to ask you is, because you failed to file a reconsideration in a timely manner on the very grounds that you now present, which is that this what the judge did below was wrong because it wasn't a consent motion. It was not a joint motion below. It was simply she assumed consent when there wasn't consent. How can we reach that in the absence of a timely appeal? Because the only thing before us is this motion for relief from judgment, which says nothing about and does not address the error that you now are raising claimed below. Do you understand what I mean?
Yes, I think so.
And I'm just wondering, how would you help me get to your argument and say, you know, Mr. Caldwell raised something that's very meritorious and that we have jurisdiction over because it was done in a timely manner below?
Judge,
I'm having trouble. I understand the argument very clearly, and I'm just having trouble. How do I reach it in the absence of a timely reconsideration below?
She did admit in her final order, which was timely appealed to this commission, that the reconsideration was within time, and therefore she considered it to be timely and denied it. I filed a notice of appeal here, and that's why we're here today. I was in the process of responding to his writ for eviction, which occurred. I had to leave the premises. The weather was very bad during that period. I had to pack up all my files, and this to me was part of the context of a settlement that they never intended to fulfill. It would cause me disruption, and one way or the other, either throw my case files out or not be able to make timely submissions. As soon as I was relocated and was able to do so, I submitted to Judge Pearson the complete scenario of what took place and why it occurred. If you can forgive Mr. Cole for errors that are not premised on bad faith, then I would ask this body to do the same in this regard.
Okay.
You can check the record of this case and go to the LTB docket, and you will see that I never missed a filing date, and I always appeared for the hearings. The only reason I wouldn't be able to do so would be ill health or, as I just explained, because I was reacting to his writ of eviction and I didn't want to have a confrontation with the U.S. Marshals. As soon as the weather was suitable, I moved.
Okay.
And then I was able to submit the documents that you have before you.
No questions yet.
Judge, do you have any questions, Mr. Cole?
No, I want to hear from the other side.
Okay. Please continue if you want, but I think you've gotten to the legal question that's within our jurisdiction to consider, you know, and I think your point is clear about what you perceive to be a procedural error below, a failure to comply with the regulations, their own regulations, that is Office of Administrative Hearing Regulations by Judge Pearson. In making a motion that was really a one-party motion, make it appear to be a joint motion when in fact it wasn't. I think that's the essence of the legal argument. Am I correct?
Yes.
Is that how you understand it,
mm-hmm.
Commissioner Spencer? Commissioner? Okay.
I beg your pardon. Is there something else pending before the Court of Appeals at this time?
Yes. Two appeals are currently pending, and we have a hearing October 7 in the case that Mr. Cole feels this settlement caused to be the end of litigation according to the doctrine of finality, but that doesn't apply except when he wants to put it on the tenant as opposed to the corporate counsel. And I would just like the court to note that Judge Rankin, who approved this without reading it, without asking any questions, there was no colloquy. The Court of Appeals in Harvey versus Etheridge Owner, Inc., 522 Atlantic 2nd, 1278 at 1279 AD, D.C., 1987, it was Judge Rankin who they reversed in that case precisely for the same thing he did in this case. That adds context to the invalidity of this settlement.
And if the outcome of the Superior Court matter is in your favor, how do you perceive it impacting why we're here today?
Mr. Cole is seeking to have me incarcerated for failure to pay a sanction based on an oral motion for sanction. That is the continuing series of events and hearings that are taking place in the landlord-tenant now. At the same time, opening briefs, I filed my opening brief, his brief is due in the appeal, and I've asked for consolidation for a single argument because they concern the two cases for possession that Mr. Cole initiated, and we're awaiting decisions on those. The other appeal has been briefed and argued. That concerned the water billing, which the settlement was supposed to obviate, and on December 18, prior to the date when I was supposed to move out, on December 31 of 2015, Mr. Cole's client, Stu Baker's Submetering, Inc., sent me a bill dated December 18 for $2,144.66. I sent him a certified letter with the bill. I said, please contact your clients. We agreed to settle this. No answer, no response, except a unilateral motion to dismiss in this case and every other case. And the same judge, chief judge of the Court of Appeals on March 10, 2016, for the same reasons Mr. Cole put forth in all of the motions to dismiss, the chief judge denied his motion to dismiss.
I have a question for you. But for Horning's alleged breach of the agreement from LTB, would you have considered this agreement to be effective?
That was my understanding at the time, that we agreed. Yes, I entered it in good faith.
So was it your understanding on November 5th of 2015 that you were done? Like, the case, all your cases were settled with Horney?
Yes, and I was awaiting the paperwork from him to sign, to file, and then give him the copies. And he neglected to do that, although he agreed to do it, and then repudiated that at the landlord-tenant branch. He said, if I didn't like this settlement, my remedy was to go in and file a motion to reopen. I did that. We had a hearing on January 19th before the Honorable Judge Campbell. He opposed it. He repudiated it. He said, I'm not going to sit here and reopen this settlement. The judge denied my motion. The next thing he filed said, if I have a problem with this settlement, file a motion to reopen. Well, it's kind of like being in magical thinking. He says, filed the motion. He repudiates it, and then tells me to file it again. It's rather Kafkaesque, if you will, allow.
Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Caldwell, so you will have 5 minutes after Mr. Cole's presentation to rebut. I would ask you to focus on what he said so that the rebuttal would then be focused on, rather than making new arguments, focus on responding to what Mr. Cole said. Mr. Cole, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Yes, Your Honor. The decision by Judge Pearson was absolutely correct in dismissing this case. While the motion requesting dismissal was actually filed by me, and I suppose technically Mr. Caldwell at that point did not consent to my filing that motion, under the settlement agreement, paragraph, and I will agree with Mr. Caldwell that the attorney mediator who wrote this has should go back to school for penmanship, but it is clear that it says in paragraph 2, tenant warrants and represents that no later than November 13th, 2015, he will file a motion with D.C. Office of Administrative Hearings, a consent motion to dismiss tenant petition number 2015 DHCD 30710. Now, the reason I had to file that motion was because Mr. Caldwell would not file that motion, and he was under an obligation to do so under this agreement. Under the terms of this agreement, the landlord agreed to waive $8,964 in rent that was due at the time we negotiated that, which was on the day of trial. We also agreed to waive the rent which would be due through December 31st, and the money that was in the registry at the time, which was $2,128. Because Mr. Caldwell, he did receive all of those funds. All those funds were forgiven. We did a disbursement order on the day of the trial, and he received those funds, I'm assuming. He also received the benefit of those additional 2 months living in the apartment without paying anything. But just to be clear, he didn't actually move out when he was supposed to. He took another 3 months' benefit of rent. So all told, in exchange for this contract, Mr. Caldwell received about $14,000 in benefits, and all he had to do was to dismiss a case before the Office of the Administrative Hearings and 2 cases before the Court of Appeals. And I would submit that because the contract says that it was supposed to be filed as a consent motion, it was perfectly within Judge Pearson's determination to conclude that the motion was a consent motion. It was an approved settlement agreement. Judge Rankin's signature is right here. The parties appeared before Judge Rankin. I don't think Mr. Caldwell is going to dispute this. The agreement was reviewed by the judge, and it was approved. This is a judicial order, and Mr. Caldwell was obligated to comply with it. It is a complete waste of resources for Mr. Caldwell not to do the things that he has done, that he was supposed to do in this, because here we are, when he was supposed to dismiss that tenant petition, here we are arguing at the Rental Housing Commission as to whether or not the tenant petition should have been dismissed. Same thing for the Court of Appeals. I think that simply as a matter of public policy, what Judge Pearson did was the appropriate remedy. Clearly, Mr. Caldwell received, had there was a contract, it was approved by the court, he received the consideration to which he was entitled, and the case should have been dismissed. And that's basically the point that I'm making. We did not need to litigate the facts before Judge Pearson, because the fact that we gave Mr. Caldwell this much consideration and he agreed to do the things that he did, that we don't have to litigate those issues. And he received the benefit of it, and it should have been dismissed. And I think that Judge Pearson had it exactly correct.
We have, we have jurisdiction. Mr. Cole, over issues that aren't raised in an appeal through what we call plain error, where a court below just makes an error that neither party raises or briefs, and the question I have, And my colleagues will have or have also mentioned is how the legal support for Judge Pearson's taking what was essentially a unilateral or appeared could appear to be a unilateral appellee motion, construe what should have been a motion not by the appellee but by the appellant, which is who would have filed the motion for voluntary dismissal, but construe it as kind of a consent motion based on a settlement agreement which really didn't mention didn't even address the type of motion that the tenant should have been making to dismiss this appeal. So I'm just having trouble trying to understand what support, legal support, she had for construing a settlement agreement as essentially a Rule 41B motion, you know, as a joint motion, when really it was only filed by one party and the other party wasn't given an opportunity to respond to it and say, yeah, I agree to this or not agree to this. Couldn't that be perceived, or how would you argue that that's not kind of a plain error in this regard?
Well, two things. Number one, I would submit that this is a rather unusual situation where you have a settlement agreement approved in Superior Court requiring one party to act in a certain way, and then when that party refuses to do it, the other party, in the interest of trying to save resources both for themselves and for the system, files a motion which is completely consistent with what Mr. Caldwell was supposed to do. So I think that it is not a stretch for Judge Pearson to have concluded that this essentially was a consent motion, because Mr. Caldwell was obligated as a matter of law to do what was in that motion. And he did have a chance to respond to it.
At the time you filed this motion with the court below, were you aware that Mr. Caldwell did no longer consent to that? Or were you unaware?
Did I know that Mr. Caldwell... I knew that Mr. Caldwell had not filed the motion, and he had told me that he was not going to file that motion.
And as an officer of the court, in filing your, as was referred to, consent motion before Judge Pearson, did you affirmatively, as an officer of the court, make Judge Pearson aware that you were aware that Mr. Caldwell no longer consented to the dismissal of that case?
To be perfectly honest, Judge Epps, I do not recall whether or not I did that or not. I will let my motion speak for itself, but I do not have a specific recollection what my representations were. I believe that I did make clear in the body of my motion that this was something that Mr. Caldwell was supposed to do and didn't do.
You would agree, however, as an officer of the court, when filing motions, to note for the judicial officer if you have affirmative knowledge of the other party's position at the time of filing?
Yes.
There's a case one of my colleagues found, 453 A2nd 113 Box versus Smith Management, and ironically at a time that I was clerking at the Court of Appeals back in the early 80s, and Judge Kern wrote, in somewhat of a similar situation, appellee's motion to dismiss relied entirely upon Rule 41A. Appellee did not move for involuntary dismissal under 41B, nor for dismissal under Rule 12, nor for summary judgment. However, Rule 41A is a plaintiff's remedy. It does not specifically provide rights to defendants to obtain dismissal based on alleged out-of-court stipulations of dismissal. Rather, as two very early opinions suggest, the appropriate procedure to raise the issue of a stipulation or agreement to dismiss a suit is on the merits as an affirmative defense or on a motion for summary judgment if there is no genuine issue of material fact. So absent Mr. Caldwell's consent, and in fact, if we analogize this to a 41A motion where it would have been filed or should have been filed by the plaintiff, not by the defendant, or excuse me, the appellant, not by the appellee in this matter, I just wonder if Judge Pearson didn't maybe overstepped her authority in interpreting this motion as a joint motion consistent with OAH regulations that require it to be a joint motion. If it were simply a voluntary dismissal, it would have been initiated otherwise under 41B simply by Mr. Caldwell, not by you. You would have, if he didn't raise it, you would have raised it as an affirmative defense or as a motion for summary judgment based on no issue of material fact, because the settlement agreement covered all the factual basis. But it wouldn't have been done simply, it couldn't have been done under the umbrella of a joint motion. It would have had to have been in response to the motion that he would have initiated. I'm just having trouble making this a joint motion and interpreting that under the appropriate regulations. Can you help me in this regard?
I think that to read this as a joint motion, you have to look at the body of the settlement agreement, which said that Mr. Caldwell would file the motion.
Okay. So the jointness comes from this, again, relying on her, that if, in fact, the settlement agreement placed a legal obligation on Mr. Caldwell to make the filing, which he did not do, at least the settlement agreement indicated that he consented to that, that he would have not consented to that provision of the settlement agreement had he not been committed to file the motion himself.
I think that given that Mr. Caldwell, in order to set aside the settlement agreement, had to do that in Superior Court, and he did not do that, I think that reading this agreement as saying, I think that is the step that you would use to say that it was within Rule 41.
Okay.
Why would you have not taken leave of Superior Court and brought to the attention Mr. Caldwell's failing to abide by the settlement agreement in lieu of filing your own motion?
I did, Your Honor. I absolutely did. And that was argued before Judge Irving. And Judge Irving, that was at the hearing before Judge Irving, Mr. Caldwell was ordered to either dismiss these cases or pay $300 a month towards this $13,000 that he received the benefit of under the settlement agreement.
And thereafter you chose to file your motion before Judge Pearson?
No, that was well before that.
So before you chose to file your motion before Judge Pearson, is that when you sought the relief of Superior Court in his failing to timely file?
No. I sought my motion before Superior Court, I believe, after I filed my motion to Judge Pearson.
So again, as an officer of the court, if you're insisting that the layperson seek assistance from Superior Court in order to enforce the agreement that you and the other parties entered into, it calls into question why you, as an officer of the court, did not seek that same assistance initially by seeking him to follow through the steps of filing a motion to dismiss rather than taking it into your own hands.
Commissioner? No questions for you.
Commissioner Harris, any more questions?
Would you Would you have thought Judge Pearson would have erred if she chose to deny your motion because if she was presumably more affirmatively aware or otherwise of Mr. Caldwell's objection to your motion for dismissal? If she had chosen not to accept him, would you have found that to have been error?
I don't know that I would have found it to be error. I would have filed in something else after that, though.
Back in Superior Court before Judge Pearson in an effort to enforce the settlement agreement you thought was still binding?
I would have to look at that, but I think I could have filed it as a summary judgment motion as well here in the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Could you speak a little bit more why you thought you could file it as a summary judgment?
I didn't get to that point, but I think that based on res judicata, Mr. Caldwell is attempting to get the benefit of a settlement agreement and receive the consideration for it, and then also get the benefit of being able to litigate his tenant petition that the landlord had clearly negotiated with him that they would not have to do. And I think that under the concept of res judicata, he would be clearly barred from pursuing that in the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Would it be and just taking again the enforcement of a settlement agreement, as I say, is not within our jurisdiction. So given that there have been allegedly breaches on both sides of this agreement, and I have no idea how effective it is right now or what its status is, and nor is that before us, but all of these alleged breaches, what's coming before, you know, this is a history. What troubles me here is that we're dealing with, at one point there was consensus. At one point there was a settlement agreement reached. Regardless of, both parties signed it, both parties entered it in good faith, apparently, at least from the record. There's no indication of bad faith at the front end. But this thing is unwound pretty quickly. And all of the litigation subsequent to that, especially here, there's a lot of wreckage already on both, you know, allegedly on both sides of not compliance, failure to comply with this agreement. So we're going back to, we have to go back to the initial consent to it. And since then, on both sides, there have been claims that there's been lack of compliance with the terms. He didn't file what he should have filed. You didn't do what you were supposed to do in honoring, cleaning up the apartment, et cetera, you know, in making sure that it was compliant with the housing regs, et cetera. So what I'm trying to get at here, Mr. Cole, is this just a question of enforcement? Is this a Superior Court action that we really, at this point, it's a question of enforcement that on both sides we can't unravel? Trying to unravel this to that point of consensus is very, very difficult. And if that's to be done, it can only be done effectively in Superior Court. It's not something that can be done on the administrative side, which really has no enforcement power. Do you understand what I mean? I mean, are we the right venue for this type of action, or is this, in your view, still fundamentally an enforcement action that is beyond our jurisdiction?
You know, quite frankly, I'm not quite sure where all of our litigation with Mr. Caldwell goes from here, because, quite frankly, the Superior Court hasn't been able to enforce the landlord's rights in here either. We've, as you now know, already argued one of the cases that was supposed to be dismissed before the Court of Appeals. We're about to argue a second one that's going before the Court of Appeals. I'm assuming that whatever happens here, this is probably going to go to the Court of Appeals as well. So, I mean, I honestly don't know what to tell you, but, I mean, the bottom line is the landlord is expending tremendous resources on litigating cases that we've already paid to have dismissed. And I honestly don't practice before the Rental Housing Commission very often. I will say that in response to Commissioner Epps' repeated suggestions that I was not complying with my obligations, I think that I may not have put a specific statement in there that Mr. Caldwell does not consent, but if you read the body of that motion, it's pretty clear what I was saying in that motion, and the facts were there was no misrepresentation as to the state of things at all. And, quite frankly, I don't know how to answer your question, Commissioner Skinny-Mazak. I think that the decision by Judge Pearson was the appropriate decision given the facts in that agreement. But.
And would you also, I guess the other question I have is, in the absence of a direct appeal or a direct motion for reconsider, a timely one where the correctness of Judge Pearson's interpretation of that rule is making it joint, how do we reach it? And how is it even reachable? Because what we have before us is a motion that was construed, that construed a untimely reconsideration as being a motion for relief from judgment under these very specific criteria. That's how she evaluated it. She said, I can't reach anything other than these criteria. I would think that you would agree with that whole formulation, right?
Well, I mean, I think it gets to a question of whether or not this tribunal even has jurisdiction to reconsider Mr. Call, the decision that was made in this case. If his motion for reconsideration was not timely filed and his appeal was not timely filed, then I'm not sure this body has the jurisdiction to even reach the merits of what he's claiming.
Okay. Commissioner Epps, any more questions?
Do you think that the way in which the mediator below memorialized the agreement with regard to whose responsibility it was to dismiss the action did it with sufficient specificity?
Yes, I absolutely do. It says, tenant warrants and represents that no later than November 13, 2015, he will file with the D.C. Office of Administrative Hearings a consent motion to dismiss tenant petition 2015-DHCD-30710 with prejudice.
Yes. So we as legal professionals understand that the underpinning that is, as the chairman described, is a 48A motion, which is essentially what you have filed. And so I guess kind of dovetailing back, when Judge Pearson interpreted your motion in that way, you don't feel that might have been an error in any way? Because she essentially was kind of forced into doing so, accepting your writing based on the description in the agreement between the parties.
Because I think it was a justifiable decision.
Okay. Based on interpreting what the parties agreed to do initially back in November.
Yes.
Question for you. The two appeals that are in D.C. Court of Appeals, are those the two that's referenced here in the agreement?
Yes.
Okay.
One of them has been argued, and one of them is being briefed.
Thank you.
And how did you respond to the chief, what Mr. Caldwell said was the chief judge's dismissal of your argument as being?
Well, I concluded that the Court of Appeals is probably not used to deciding cases on summary judgment motions and typically will defer to oral argument on matters. So, I mean, that's just me. They didn't give me a long decision as to their consideration, but I assume that it had to do with simply following a case through the normal track as opposed to dismissing it in a manner which would be inconsistent with their typical practice.
Okay. Commissioner?
No.
Commissioner?
No.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Cole. Mr. Caldwell, 5 minutes, and to respond to Mr. Cole.
Thank you, Your Honor. As a result of Chief Judge Washington's order, he had to file briefs. He's not trying to bring forth dismissal to the Court of Appeals. He may argue that, as he did on February 30, before a panel, and by implication, they stated that this was the wrong forum, and Judge Inez Reed held this up and said, you're basing your dismissal on this settlement? He said, yes. Then she asked me, did you appeal it? And at that point, I have not. But I did subsequently. And the notice of appeal, for some strange reason, disappeared in the landlord-tenant court. But Judge Campbell's approval to proceed in informa pauperis on appeal, his order made it into the record. So a lot of strange things here. Mr. Cole states that at November 5, 2015 hearing before Judge Rankin at the approval, that we discussed this. No, we did not. There was no discussion. There was no colloquy. He asked Mr. Cole, do you agree to settle? He said yes. He asked me, do you agree to settle? I said yes. He signed the orders, and that was the extent of the discussion. There are tapes. So when Mr. Cole represents that there was discussion, the elements were put forth so that the parties understood, this is simply not true. The tapes are there. They are not altered. The other thing that is most important is Judge Pearson readily admits that she went outside the rules. She went out, the rules are codified, and it's the same as laws. So she essentially violated the law to give Mr. Cole everything he wanted. And that's not fair, that's not moral, it's unjust and illegal.
Question for you.
Yes, sir.
Why shouldn't we believe that when you file disagreement with the court and both parties sign it, that pretty much sufficed as a dismissal, a voluntary dismissal on your part?
Because Mr. Cole and his clients breached it ever before my first breach.
So, no, let's stop for a second. Let's not think about the breaches. Let's just think, again, when you, both parties signed this agreement and filed it with the court, why shouldn't we consider that to be an act of dismissal?
Because it hadn't been completed. The settlement agreement is but the first step. Until the parties fulfill their obligations, oral and written, it's not final.
Okay.
That's a matter of law that I believe I put forth in my briefs. Now, I, in good faith, entered into the contract. I was expecting Mr. Cole to send me the dismissal papers. What happened was the division of transcripts at the Superior Court sent me a notice, your transcripts are ready. That had been requested prior to the settlement. I went over there, I picked them up, that triggered a notice to the Court of Appeals, a briefing schedule was issued. He wrote me a letter with a copy of that order saying, you were supposed to dismiss these cases. I wrote back and said, you've forgotten that you were going to send me the paperwork. We had indicated that you would formulate them, email them to Miss the landlady, Amber Sittum, at the property office. She would let me know. I'd come down, pick him up, go to all the courts, sign him, give him his copies. He didn't do that. I sent him that notice by certified mail. He ignored it. Then he filed unilaterally all the motions to dismiss. And then his client sent me a bill for thousands of dollars on this dated December 18, which is also in the briefs. I sent another letter by certified mail to him. Please, this was, and I direct your attention, which I eventually discern, Clause 5 and Clause 7 speaks to global settlement, not in those terms, but the words are sufficient to sustain that, and that at the end of the day, neither side would owe anyone anything.
So essentially, if you had not received the additional bill for the I think it's water
usage.
Waterville,
yes, ma'am.
You would not have, we wouldn't be here today. You would, his motion, everything would have been fine, correct?
That is right, had they lived up to their end of the agreement.
So prior to the bill being received, his filing of this, as you've, this filing of the dismissal would have met with your approval, but for the water bill.
Well, but the, you've got to understand how it actually occurred. I said, I sent him what papers I formulated to dismiss with prejudice. He's got them. I've got copies of them. He ignored those and filed his own unilateral motions to dismiss. So I thought, well, this is very strange. I'm still willing, if you're willing. That was the first event. The second event, December 18, was the bill for thousands of dollars. Sent him another certified letter, which he got and ignored. Then he went to court and said, that wasn't part of the agreement. He owes us money for the water. Where do you see that in the agreement with Studebaker Submetering, Inc.? And the judges said, well, I don't see it here. Therefore, it's not there.
But for the issue of the water, you would agree that it had been appropriate to dismiss all the matters. Is that correct?
If we had submitted the joint motion, but he chose to repudiate that and file his own dismissal motions unilaterally, which then, of course, I opposed. That was after, this took place in January.
I see. Thank you.
And so I breached by not leaving on December 31 because I was awaiting fulfillment. And by January 19, before Judge Campbell, I asked, let's reopen this. Let's talk about this again. Let's settle it now. He said, no, I'm not interested in reopening the settlement. The only obligations, according to Judge Campbell, was for you to have moved out on the 31st of December. There are no other obligations under this bilateral contract.
What about the first obligation as far as the filing the consent motion?
Yes, by November 13, the consent motions to dismiss would be filed. He agreed on November 5 to formulate the paperwork, get it to me so that it could be done in a timely manner. He didn't do it. And
so would you explain if that is that the first act that didn't occur as it was supposed to based on the agreement?
Yes.
So you're saying he was supposed to type the motion for you?
Yes. He's the professional. I wanted, and at the meeting, we said, well, Mr. Cole, you're the attorney, so your clients are perfectly satisfied, and the mediator agreed to this. Everybody agreed. You formulate the paperwork, get it to me, give it to, email it to Ms. Stidham over at the Brooklyn Ridge Apartments. She'll telephone me. I'll come down, get the hard copy, sign them, file it.
So his failure to do that, why didn't you do it yourself?
Because I was waiting for him to do it. And then when he wrote a letter saying, I just got a scheduling order, an appeal, you were supposed to dismiss, I wrote back with the paperwork formulated by me, and I said, do you approve of this? Again, silence.
Yeah, I guess I have a hard time reconciling your inaction, I guess, with your own interest in the case. I think as the chairman pointed out at the opening, your writing is pretty impressive, and you are clearly very intelligent. So again, even though he's the attorney, I guess I have a hard time understanding why you failed to file the motion simply because he failed to email it to you.
Because he placed me at an extreme disadvantage, and I would just direct the court's attention. Now, it's a Massachusetts case, but if counsel agrees to file paperwork and then does not do so and places the promisee at a disadvantage by his own failure to formulate paperwork he has agreed to do, the promisee, the tenant, cannot be held responsible for the breach committed by the...
How do you reconcile that with the notion that we're expected to look at this agreement and read it as it is, right? On one hand, you're saying it doesn't cause for a joint motion for the dismissal of your tenant petition. But if we read these words here, they say the tenant will file the consent motion, not the attorney. So again, if that was your contention, it was going to be your disadvantage, why didn't you make sure this agreement stated that he was supposed to write that agreement for you, write that motion for you?
Because I entered into this in good faith, and I assumed the oral obligations and agreements would be honored as well as the written ones. I couldn't readily discern the written ones, but I just heard them, and it's a consent motion. That means both parties have to sign and agree to it. He agreed to formulate the paperwork. I agreed that that would be the best option. He didn't do it, I tried to get him to sign a consent motion. He didn't do that. He signed and submitted unilateral motions for dismissal.
Did you get any help writing your briefs? Did anyone write this stuff for you or help you read the agreement?
No, I have to take responsibility.
So again, I guess I have a hard time reconciling your inability to read this agreement with your ability to cite it verbatim in your documents.
Well, that's because when I was younger, I studied Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Okay.
And by dint of long study of these...
I just had one last question. The two breaches, as you've described, one had to do with counsel's not providing you with a rough draft of a proposed motion, and the other had to do with, an alleged oral agreement about a water bill. Are those the two essential breaches you've described that were a breach in that agreement?
Yes.
And both of those breaches that you're relying on are things that just did not make it into the four corners of the agreement. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And also, if we had had the colloquy that Judge Rankin was required to give us under the law, I think much of this would have been avoided.
And you didn't feel at the time to just make sure that, especially because evidently there was quite a financial stake in the water, to have mentioned it somewhere in the four corners?
Oh, I assumed that he was going to do that in good faith because the briefs had been filed, the arguments before the Court of Appeals had been made, and or that he would want to get rid of that case. And so it just was a complete surprise that he wouldn't respond to certified mail, wouldn't live up to his end of the contract, and charged me thousands of dollars. Now, you know, in the court below, I put forth the fact that I was overcharged rent in the amount of $21,400. So he claims that this $13,645 that I'm owed, prior to that, for the 12 years I was there, I paid timely $148,100 in rent. I never got the goods and services I was supposed to get. That's the merits of the case, and I realize we're not here about that, but those are the issues and why this is so complicated that he had an opportunity to avoid. And because he decided essentially to negate the contract, the part that represented tenants' interests and concentrates solely on the corporate clients' interests to the detriment of the tenant, I felt I had no obligation but to consider go forward and bring it to the attention of the various courts, what was really going on.
My last question for you. Prior to these alleged breaches here, did you have a good relationship? Did you trust the management company?
No. I had given them notice in June 8 of 2008 that there were various things concerning the grounds, the apartment, and the building. The security door was never functioning properly. There was at least one break-in. I don't know. He did not cooperate at all in discovery, even though the two different judges ordered him to do so. Notices of violation that are in my appendix, I got through subpoena. He said, we've looked at our files, there's nothing there, even though they were served and the notices of service are attached to the notices of violation.
Okay.
So
the answer is just no. you didn't trust him prior to this?
I didn't trust the management. Okay. I didn't know him.
Well, you told me management, not Mr. Cole, personally.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't know Mr. Cole until he filed his first case for possession, February 20, 2014.
Okay, thank you.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. This offers an opportunity, a wealth of opportunities, in a different to address a number of issues. We intend then to reach a decision and issue a decision in writing in the next 30 to 45 days. Thank you for your forbearance. I realize this has gone on considerably longer. We have a lot of questions. This case raised a lot of questions to obviously to all of us. So, but we greatly appreciate the time and the effort you've put in. And so we look forward then to issuing a decision in the next 30 to 45 days. It's now 3:11, and this hearing is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.